not. I could do this thing, though, and I tried so hard to make it right, and Alex is looking at it now. Ornaments so old that not even my mom can justify using them are transformed by the frozen dew and the moon, every inch screaming with a beauty that will dissolve in the sunlight. Dime store ribbon tied into bows, razor sharp with ice, will be wilted trash in a few hours when reality steps in. But this isn't reality, and this isn't the morning. It's now, and it's my moment, and I reclaim Alex's hand and take a deep breath, and she says, "Tell me about Sarah's uncle."
Chapter 41. Alex. It shouldn't be this easy. There are laws in place that stop us from doing things. This is what we tell ourselves. In truth, we stop ourselves. The law is a guideline for how to punish someone who is caught. Claire's dad likes to say that everything happens for a reason. He must say it a lot because I've been at her house only a handful of times and have heard the phrase at least twice. And if he's right, then maybe I'm supposed to hear him. Maybe Claire was supposed to get that text from Sarah tonight when I would see her face. Maybe she was supposed to have too much to drink and cry in the car, sharing memories of the times she'd been with Sarah at her uncle's house. Maybe she was supposed to point it out as I drove past, choking on words so harsh she can't say them even with beers slicking her throat. "Guess I was lucky," she says. "I live in a world where not being molested as a child is considered luck. A fire has been lit inside of me, and if everything happens for a reason, then the kindling has been laid for years, piled nicely as it waited for a spark. And tonight was steel on flint, a heat pulsing within that keeps me warm even in the cold, even as I stand outside his home in the dead of night. After I dropped Claire off, I tried to do the right thing, tried to be normal. I checked my phone for texts, I walked to the side door, I reached for the doorknob, and then I was running, my feet punching through snow and leaving a dark path behind me. Now it's his door in front of me, not my own. People don't lock up here. They call it trust, but I say it's arrogance, an assumption that nothing bad will happen. Not to them. I let myself in. He's asleep on the couch. The lamp on the side table illuminates his half-eaten dinner, now decorated with a fat winter fly bogged down in the mashed potatoes. Still struggling a little, thread-like legs pushing against gravy. He fell asleep with the TV on, the colors flickering across his face as I watch him. The steady rise and fall of his chest, his bare feet on the floor, nails that need to be clipped. The awkward angle of his neck, head resting to the side. He'll have a crick in the morning. Maybe. I could leave now. There are reasons why I should. There are reasons to stay, too. I take my time, touching things, moving through the small rooms of his life to see what he keeps. And he does keep things. Things no one should have. I go through pictures, grainy but with enough detail to know what I'm looking at. Now I can't leave. He burns wood for warmth, the iron stove in the center room emitting heat like a wall that I move through as I walk toward it. There's a small shovel for cleaning out ash, leaning against the stove, cocked toward me as if an invitation. It really shouldn't be this easy. When I dump the embers in his lap, his clothing ignites. His eyes fly open, but he does not see me. There is only confusion, a lack of comprehension so great that it trumps even the pain. The elasticized band of his underwear liquefies and runs across his skin, the tiny hairs on his belly flaming for a brief fiery moment before becoming ash. His hands go immediately to the pain, wanting to cup it and cover the hurt. But there is no comfort in the movement. Blisters open and break in a moment, and his sleeves catch, fire creeping up his arms as he staggers to his feet. He wants to run now, the second instinctive reaction to pain. but he doesn't know where to go, and the coffee table is in his way, cracking against his shins hard enough to break skin, but even that does not stop him as he bolts. He heads for the bedroom, liquid flame lighting the carpet in his wake as parts of his sweater drip to the floor. That room calls to him even as he burns, a black hole that he flies toward, his melting hands providing mutual destruction for the pictures I laid out on the bed. I don't follow because I don't need to see. I can hear. Animals die in the woods all the time. I've heard their screams, startlingly human, as they fight something stronger, faster, bigger. But there's a final moment when they know the battle is lost, when the prey goes still and accepts fate, a passive agreement with the predator that they have been bested. That silence follows the smoke down the hallway, and I know it's over. The small fires that dropped around him have grown, licking up the carpet fibers, and now searching for more. They creep toward me, and I've spent too much time watching. I head for the door, my eyes watering against the smoke, and my throat tightening against the fumes of the smoldering carpet. Yet, I can't move fast because there's an unfamiliar weight in my stomach, and I fight against it as I hit the cold, clear air, my feet finally picking up speed as I run down the driveway, to the road, past the woods, places I can't leave footprints. What was his home is now a pillar of smoke, bits of ash falling from the sky, all that's left of any number of horrific acts. But that's not what puts me on my knees. That's not what makes me vomit. The steam from it rising back up in my face as I retch again and again. The weight in my gut is gone, leaving behind a dark pit and strained muscles. I lie back in the snow, my body quivering. I don't know what to do. For the first time in a long time, I don't know what I think. Because that empty space inside me, it feels like guilt.
Chapter 42, Jack. Sound travels when the air is freezing. Even with the storm windows, I can hear a train, though the tracks are so far away I can't see the lights. Its thrum supersedes the constant sound of the breeze moving through the pines near the house, the low grunt of a deer that had been passing through the yard as it sees something it doesn't like. I hear it bolt, hooves breaking through the frozen snow as it flees. I can't sleep, and it's got nothing to do with noises. I've been hearing these things my whole life, same as I've been staring at this crack in the ceiling my whole life. For some people, the constant things are reassurance. They find comfort in the fact that nothing ever changes. But I'm not like that. And right now, I hate the crack in my ceiling. I hate the train for existing, and I especially hate the wind for moving the pines outside and reminding me that I'm going to have to go back to the clearing and get all the stupid fucking decorations off that tree. I curl my fist under my head, fighting the urge to punch the wall. I told Alex that I love her, right after explaining about Sarah's uncle. Her eyes did the right thing, lit up as bright as the snow all around us. But her mouth was all wrong, still fused shut with an inexpressible anger. She actually said, "Thank you," which was worse than saying nothing at all. We stared at each other for a few seconds after that, another awkward silence like the one after she attacked Ray Parsons descending around us. I hate not knowing what to say to Alex, and of course, here in my bed, I've come up with all kinds of great things, words that would have smoothed over my bad timing and loosened some of the muscles around her lips. But those things didn't come to me when I needed them, so we walked back to the church, Alex with her hands in her pockets, eyes on the ground, and her face as cold as the wind. PK had had too much to drink, and Alex drove her home, giving me a half-hearted wave as she got into the car. The train is gone, taking its vibrant hum with it. I'm left with the wind and the crack on my ceiling, and all the things I could have done differently tonight, when there's a tap on my window. I ignore it, focused on the crack, wondering if there's any old caulk out in the garage, and if I can sneak out and get it without my parents wondering what the hell I'm doing fixing my ceiling at 4 in the morning. The sound comes again, followed quickly by another, more insistent. I roll over and push the curtain aside to see Alex standing in the driveway, arm pulled back to throw another stone. I wave to her, and she drops it, motioning for me. I know how to dress quickly and quietly, know which spots on the stairs creak loudly, and how to open the screen door just right without making a sound. But I don't know how to do any of these things with my heart beating so hard I can see it in my chest, or with my blood rushing so fast there are dark corners in my vision. It's the sloppiest sneaking out I've ever done, but I don't care. If Alex is standing in my yard in the middle of the night, it means she thinks things were unsaid too, and maybe she couldn't sleep either. Maybe she's been lying on her bed, staring at her ceiling, thinking about me, and that's exactly what I'll tell Mom and Dad if they wake up. Some things are too important to wait. I'm outside, the snow tumbling over the sides of my shoes and slipping down against my bare skin because I didn't take the time to put on socks. Alex comes toward me, hands out, and I take them, our freezing skin meeting. "Hey," she says, her voice harsh and scratchy. Her face is streaked with frozen tears, her cheeks stretched and hard underneath them. Her eyelashes are stuck together, dark icicles framing red-rimmed eyes. "Alex, what are you doing?" I put my hands on her face, rubbing my thumbs over the salt left behind there. It chafes away, blowing into the breeze and leaving redness behind. Her whole face is stiff in my hands, and I try to pull her into me for heat, but she pushes away. "I need to talk to you," she says, her voice dark and unfamiliar. I take a step back. I know this tone. I've seen these movements, seen them in Mom when we lost Grandpa, in Park when he found out his little sister had cancer. Physical pain we reach for, protect, treat, pain that comes from the inside we try to push out, working it free in little worrying movements of the hands, eyes that dart everywhere as if expending all the energy inside will help mine down to the pain, expose it and drag it out into the open, out where someone else can see it and help kill it. Alex is in pain. It's written everywhere. Every muscle she has is fluttering. She's like a wild animal ready to bolt, but with nowhere to go. She knows the hurt is inside and running won't help, but she came to me. To me. And there's enough pride attached to that that I feel good. And that makes me feel terrible because my girlfriend is having a breakdown. Alex takes a deep breath, lips working as she searches for words. Finally, a calm settles. One that radiates from her eyes and flows outward from there until she's not a panicked animal anymore. She's a frozen statue of my girlfriend, and as she starts to talk, I'm the one who wants to run. "Jack," she says calmly, "I have reactions to my environment that others wouldn't understand. I follow through on them because I believe in instinct. I hear a siren. A high-pitched wail as the ambulance comes screaming from town. It digs into my ears, the miles separating me from it turned into nothing by the cold winter air. The fire truck comes next, the one engine that the town owns ripping through the calm that I'd hated only a few minutes ago. What are you saying? I watch her intently, too scared to move, afraid she might bolt if I startle her. The other night you asked me about college. You said it's better if you don't go. Better for other people, Jack, she corrects me. I feel too much. Her face crumples a little, a thaw creeping in. I shouldn't be out, she says, her voice breaking. It's not safe. Alex, I say her name quietly in between siren pulses. Alex, what did you do? She closes her eyes and exhales, the warmth of her breath pluming all around her. If I don't let my feelings guide me in my actions, it's the same as not having them at all, she says. Her eyes open and she's scared again, the momentary calm shattered by the noise. I might as well not exist. You exist, I say, and she comes to me, fresh tears filling the tracks left behind by frozen ones. She's in my arms in a moment, but pulls back for 1 second to lock eyes with me. "I love you, too," she says, and my heart slams up into my throat at the same time that my stomach drops into my knees. Because Alex loves me, and she smells like smoke.
Chapter 43, PK. Alex is broken, and it's painful to see. We had this dog at the shelter once, an Irish wolfhound. Big-ass dog, gorgeous in her own way. We named her Bridget, a good Irish name, cleaned her up and put her on the shelter's Facebook page while we waited to borrow the one scanner all the surrounding counties use to check strays for microchips. The response was immediate. Everyone basically said, "What the hell is that?" People around here have golden retrievers and German shepherds, dogs that make sense, practical pets that others can identify and congratulate you on. There was interest, don't get me wrong. Lots of people stopped by just to see Bridget in the flesh, walk her out of the pity in their hearts, and then plop her back in the cage and take home a beagle, saying, "I think we're looking for something a little more normal." And Bridget, with her long face and distinctive bearing, would curl up in her cage, pride emanating from every muscle. But you could see in her eyes she was hurt. When our turn came to use the scanner, I did Bridget myself, my heart skipping a beat when I got a beep and a phone number to call. Her family was from New York, which isn't actually all that far from us if you think about it, but everyone around the shelter was so stunned they kept repeating it, as if we found out she was actually from Ireland. Her family came to get her, and not a day too late. Bridget's head had begun to hang, her food dish not emptying at a healthy rate. When she heard their voices in the waiting room, I don't think she believed it. I thought she might go ballistic, tear down the hall, dragging me by the leash like a lot of dogs do when they find their people again. But Bridget just looked at me when I clipped her leash on and opened the door, like she suspected this was another opportunity to be dragged out into public, to have someone look at her skeptically again. If that dog had middle fingers, I guarantee you she would have flipped off this entire county as she headed home in her family's Hummer. Someone finally got Alex. Someone finally realized that here, amid all the regular people and normal lives, there was a truly remarkable person. A girl who doesn't look like everyone else or even think like us. Alex is a different breed altogether, but here we just want variations of the same. The safe. The known. Someone finally saw past all that. Unfortunately, that someone was Jack Fisher. And he's the type who takes all the dogs home for an overnight, but never actually adopts any. It's been 2 weeks since they stopped talking. 2 weeks of snow and bitter cold. Ice hanging from our windows and freezing up our cars. It's dark when we wake up, and getting dark when we head home from school. Some days, it's been so cold just going outside can almost kill you. When we do have school, the wind cuts right through us as we walk toward the building, me hunched against it, Alex standing tall, not seeming to care. Her eyes have been blank, her mouth forming the right words to constitute a response. But there's nothing behind them, no feeling. I've had her over a few times, casually mentioned the names of some boys that I've caught checking her out. Because let's face it, once one person tries Irish Wolfhound, the others get curious. But she shakes her head, says she's not interested. She never misses her hours at the shelter and does all her homework, maintaining her path to valedictorian. She moves through all the scheduled events as if each day is a job, and anything more is considered overtime. I position myself in the right place at school, shielding her from Jack as he walks by, hoping my body blunts the chaotic knife of Branley's laughter as she hangs from his arm. But if she's laughing, it's not because he said something funny. Park says Jack doesn't make jokes anymore. We've tried to ask questions, me to Alex, Park to Jack, our words chosen carefully, not like we're digging to figure out why they broke up. The boys say it's because she wouldn't put out. The girls say it's because Jack always gets bored eventually. They're both utterly broken. and no one knows why.
Chapter 44. Alex. I didn't know a living person could hurt you so badly. When the pain originates with someone who is gone, it's your own memory that hurts you. Walking through the house, touching things they've touched, hearing sounds they heard, wondering what they would have thought of one thing or another. This is pain that I know, pain that I can handle, pain that is so much a part of me that if it were removed, I would not be whole. But when it's someone who's alive who hurts you, the pain can't be escaped. The things they've touched are still warm because they were just there. The sounds they hear reach your ears too, sometimes their own voice, and it's excruciating to bear. I know what he thinks about this, that, or the other, because I can hear him saying so. But not to me. He doesn't talk to me anymore. I want to take it back. Not just the words I said in the dark, his face slowly closing against me as the smoke rose from my clothes and the sirens ripped the air. I want to go back further, back to the moment where I stood at my own door. I dream about walking through it instead of spinning and running into the dark. I dream about going to sleep that night, to the smell of coconut shampoo, my phone screen glowing with whatever latest text came in from Jack. I want that instead of what happened, instead of the smoke that I still can't get out of my pillowcase, the dark screen of my phone staring back at me whenever I glance at it. I don't want the memories that I have, the smells and the sounds and all the small things I did that rounded up to one big thing. One big thing that I can't take back.
Chapter 45. Jack. It took me a while to be able to go back. The clearing is frozen solid when I finally get the nerve to sneak up the hill in Dad's truck, the chains on the tires, the only thing stopping me from sliding back down. It's been so damn cold, nobody's been out in the woods. I can't even find deer tracks. Every living thing is hunkered down waiting for spring. I am too, in a way. Every night when I go to bed, I'm thankful that there's a streak of 8 or 9 hours of unconsciousness ahead of me, time in which I don't have to think about Alex and what happened. Sleep is a kind of victory for me, because when I wake up, it means there's another day solidly behind, one more step away from that night. I want to pile time on top of itself, years upon years, so that I can forget, or at least make what she did a hazy memory. I want to jump ahead a decade to when I'm out of this damn town and the fresh grave in the cemetery has settled, and Alex is a name that doesn't feel like a slash on my heart. I kill the engine and listen to it cooling, those small mechanical noises, the only sounds out here as the sun sinks. It's easier to think when I'm alone and my brain runs through it all again. Alex's words, the smells that clung to her, the tears on her face, and the news about Sarah's uncle that tore through the halls the next day. The thing is, I've always been good at logic puzzles, and the only answer that fits says that Alex murdered someone. It could have been an accident. That's what the cops decided anyway. It wouldn't have been the first house fire this winter. We've all been freezing in our beds, the cold fingers of wind slipping through the tiny cracks to find us no matter where in the house we are. But it was the only fatal fire, and the only one where my girlfriend showed up in my driveway immediately afterward, having some kind of nervous breakdown and smelling like smoke. All those damning little things say a lot, and all the pressure that was trying to push the words "I love you" out of my mouth now wants me to scream that Alex is a killer. But I can't do that. Not where people can hear, anyway. Park wants to know what's wrong. Branley wants to know what's wrong. Everybody thinks that Alex and I got into some big fight and broke up. I almost wish we had. I wish I'd told her she was crazy, pushed her away from me. But I didn't. I held her and told her everything was going to be okay, even as the ash started to drift in from the north, heavier than the snow and darker by far. What I did was worse. I abandoned her. It started when her ringtone made me want to vomit instead of answer, the guilt plunging deep into my belly and making me choke. I couldn't read her texts, and I couldn't listen to her voicemails, scared of what she might say next, scared of what she might do next. I even stared at the pic I've still got on my phone of Officer Nolan's email and cell once or twice. But the thing is that I told her everything would be all right. I said that when this girl, who I didn't even think could bend, was completely broken, sobbing against me and hating herself. And I've been there. I know exactly what it's like to fuck up hard and not be able to fix it. So I couldn't damn her, even if what she did was so far above and beyond my own screw-ups, we can't even see each other across the gap. I let that logic have its way with me. And I've waited so long that if I rat her out now, Nolan's going to want to know why I covered for her. Even if I leave an anonymous tip, I'm screwed because we, the oh-so-happy new couple, suddenly broke up right when the shit went down, and he'll ask me questions. Questions that tear down the good guy thing I've got going on and punch holes in any chances I have at a scholarship. Alex has faded away in the past couple of weeks. Branley is highest on my recent call list, Alex's number buried somewhere behind some sophomore girl who found the courage to call me in the bottom of a bottle. I couldn't understand anything she said, but I kept the voicemail, hoping I might find it funny eventually. Branley has been doing her best to cheer me up, but I haven't touched her. She's confused and pouty about it, and while I know she could distract me for an hour or two, it would still be Alex on my mind, because fading or not, she still shines brighter than everyone else, and I have my nights when I want to call her up anyway. Fuck the fire and the smoke and the tears running down her face. God damn it, I yell, punching the horn and sending some birds out of their nests, reprimanding me with harsh voices. I get out of the truck, snagging the garbage bag I brought along. It billows in the wind behind me like a dark sail. The tree looks like shit. The ribbons I tied on with freezing fingers in anticipation of telling Alex I loved her are ripped to shreds, the ends frayed and brittle. A few of the ornaments have blown off, and I step on one accidentally. It breaks with hardly any resistance, and a million silver shards scatter across the snow. I'll never be able to get all the pieces. They'll sink down into the ground with a winter melt, non-biodegradable witnesses of my failed night that will never rot, just release whatever chemicals they're painted with. I try to scoop everything up, but every time I think I've got it, the sun hits another piece and soon my gloves are soaking wet. My fingers are painfully crooked, and I've spent a half hour trying to pick up one goddamn ornament, and I am pissed. The part of me that's held on to everything I know is swelling, a bitter anger that inflames my heart and sends my blood pushing through my veins too hard, shooting black spots across my vision as I head back to the truck. Dad's axe is in the back, and it's heavy in my hand as I take my first swing, the tree shuddering under the blow. Ornaments fall and are crushed under my boots, but I keep swinging. The pressure in my chest lightening a little with each connection, the head of the axe sticky with sap. I regret it when I'm halfway through, but it's too late. The tree leans heavily to one side, the red ribbons now faded to pink dragging on the ground. I stomp down hard on the trunk, right above the deep notch where I killed it, and the snap reverberates through the woods. It's almost dark by the time I get home, but I haul the tree out to the woodpile anyway, drag out Dad's chainsaw, and start tearing in. Mom comes out, coat wrapped tight around her body, a question on her face. I wave her away, sawdust flying around me as I take off the limbs, one by one, needles carpeting the ground at my feet. Dad gets home, and I see Mom talking to him through the kitchen window, hands moving, as alarmed as the birds in the woods. By the time Dad comes out, the cutting is done. He helps me stack in silence, not commenting on the ornament hooks still clutching in some places, or the strands of wrecked ribbon mixed with the chips on the ground. We finish, and he claps a hand on my shoulder. "Well, that's done," he says, as if cutting down a tree and stacking green wood we won't be able to burn for a year was on the list of things to do today. "Come inside and get some supper." I nod that I will, and he goes without looking back, somehow knowing that the crazy thing I just did was healthier for me than all the normal shit I've been doing every day just to get by. My arms are like lead, and my feet drag as I walk to the house. I'll sleep well tonight, solidly. I'll put today behind me, get through tonight. And maybe tomorrow I won't think of Alex the moment I open my eyes.
Chapter 46. PK. I'm calling it, I say. What's that? Sarah asks from the passenger seat. It's time for emergency girlfriend pact. She glances up from her phone. For who? Alex. She looks back down at her screen, thumbs flashing. Hmm. I stop at a light and reach over to knock the phone out of her hands. Seriously. Sarah sighs. Fine, but she's your friend, not mine. As long as you're in, I may need backup. I drive to Alex's house and we stand on the doorstep for a few minutes, listening to the knocker echo through the insides. Sarah huddles against the cold, hands jammed in her pockets. Nobody home, she proclaims. Just because nobody's answering doesn't mean nobody's home in this house. I take a chance, twist the knob, and shove my shoulder into the door. It pops open grudgingly, and I tumble inside. Seriously? Sarah says, but there might be a note of admiration in her voice. Alex? I call out, her name ringing back at me from the pristine walls. Claire? She comes to the top of the stairs, a paperback in her hands. Why are you here? Girls' night, I declare, climbing toward her, Sarah behind me. Let's go. Alex glances from me to Sarah, unsure. Sarah looks down at Alex's bare feet. You're going to need shoes, she says. And this simple statement gets Alex moving, bundling into a coat and pulling on a hat as we go out the door. Your shotgun, Sarah insists as she climbs into the back. What's this all about? Alex asks as I pull out of her driveway. We're celebrating, I tell her. Celebrating what, my kidnapping? PK has enacted emergency girlfriend pact, Sarah says. We do this anytime one of us goes through a breakup, I explain. We are celebrating your liberation from having a boyfriend. Or in my case, a girlfriend, Sarah adds. We're going to drink too much and eat too much. Fuck the world, I say. She doesn't mean that last one as a verb, does she? Alex turns in her seat to ask Sarah, and I see a twist of a smile on her face in the rearview mirror. No, Sarah answers, but the first two are definites. I ordered pizza. And I called in Chinese, I say. Any requests? I like cheeseburgers. Done. Sarah is texting in the back. Lila is working at the Grease Palace, and my brother is at the state store tonight, so hooch is covered. So where are we going right now? This is the best part, I say as I pull into the dollar store, put the car in park, and give Alex a once-over. I think code yellow, I say to Sarah. Absolutely not, she says, leaning forward and protectively cupping her hands around Alex's ponytail. You're not stripping out these raven tresses. Code red all the way. Explanation? Alex asks me, one eyebrow high. This is the part where we buy cheap dye, go home, get drunk, and color each other's hair. To my surprise, Alex is the first one out of the car. We have eaten ourselves to the point of physical pain, had too much to drink, and started a fire in the pit in my backyard, which probably wasn't the smartest choice considering our blood alcohol levels and fresh chemicals in our hair. But it doesn't matter. My mom and dad are at a church retreat for married couples, and we're making the most of it. You can really pack it in, Sarah says to Alex. You weren't kidding when you said you like cheeseburgers. I do, Alex nods, her gaze a little unfocused. I really do. You're staying the night, I inform her, and she nods, the foil wrappers in her hair catching the light from the flames. Time? I ask Sarah, who glances at her phone, her own wrappers falling forward into her face. We've got 10 minutes, she says, then we're matchy-matchy. Somewhat, I say. We decided highlights were best, A little red shot through Alex's black hair that would complement our darker browns as well. "It'll give your face some lift," Sarah explained as she mixed the chemicals, the tang burning the inside of our noses. Alex nodded as if she understood what that meant, and I had to smother a smile. "Thank you," Alex says, leaning toward me now across the fire. I touch the neck of my bottle to hers, and Sarah pops a fresh one for herself. "Are we friends?" Alex asks Sarah suddenly. Sarah takes a pull on her cider, touching her own foil and then Alex's. "Looks like it," she says. "Once enacted, emergency girlfriend pact cannot be revoked. We have matching hair now. This is serious shit." Alex smiles, her gaze going to the fire. "I'm sorry about your uncle," she says. As usual, her words carry more weight than necessary, making it sound like she was personally responsible rather than offering condolences. Sarah freezes for a second, her eyes meeting mine. I nod to let her know that I'd let Alex in on the situation, hoping that was okay. "Well," Sarah sighs heavily, "I know it might sound terrible, but it kind of made some things easier for my family. We didn't have to think about, you know, pressing charges or anything like that. It was just taken care of." Sarah snaps her fingers. Alex nods, as if this makes sense to her. "But they told us he burned," Sarah continues, all lightness gone from her voice. "Usually it's the smoke that gets them or whatever, but he burned. And I can't even imagine that kind of pain. I don't think anyone should go that way, but it's what happened." "Yeah," Alex says. "Hey, good job killing the mood," I tell them. Sarah shrugs. "Sorry." "It needed to be said," Alex adds. "I'm officially changing the subject." I reach into the dollar store bag by my side, searching for something I bought while Alex wasn't looking. Sarah's eyes light up, and she claps her hand. "Oh, you're going to love this," she tells Alex. "What?" I whip out a plastic tiara, complete with gaudy gemstones, and put it on Alex, hooking the attached barrettes into her hair. "You're wearing that to school on Monday," I tell her. "It's the breakup tiara." She nods as if this makes perfect sense, and it slips down below one eye. "I definitely will," she says, and we all clink bottles as it starts to snow.
Chapter 47, Alex. I have friends. There are people who like me, and I have discovered that I like them. Today I am wearing a child's toy on my head, walking around the school as if this were perfectly normal. When I turn my head, the tips of my hair fall over my shoulder, and I see the faintest shade of red shot through, enough to reflect the light. I touch my hand to it, rubbing my own hair between my fingers and thinking about the fact that somewhere in the school are two other girls with streaks exactly the same color as mine. I feel a burst of warmth in my gut, like the fire from Claire's backyard didn't go out, but was transferred to my insides, a place protected from the wind and snow, a place where I can think about their faces in the fire's light and how they smiled when I talked and answered me. How they listened, and I heard them too, and how we all slept on the floor in the living room, perfect trust sending our bodies into a deep unconsciousness.
"Hey, Alex, did you know that you're a slut?"
Sarah yells at me from the bathroom stall as PK checks her makeup in the mirror. "This is news," I call back. Sarah comes out, buttoning her jeans.
"Well, it says so in Branley's handwriting on the back of that door, just FYI.
"Congrats," Claire says, expertly smudging her eyeliner with the tip of her finger. "You've been denounced in the bathroom. You're officially normal." I take her eyeliner from her and smear out Branley's accusation, telling Claire I'll buy her new makeup. She laughs, and Sarah takes the pen, turning my nondescript smudge into a huge piece of shit that is startlingly accurate. There's a code here that I never knew how to read until now, and it's more than just the high fives other girls are giving me in the hallways when they spot my tiara. Now that I'm out, I am seeing the way some of them talk to one another, not guarded and looking for hurt, but open. The flash of teeth and the upward lilt in a voice when it's spoken by a mouth that's smiling. These are all things that were foreign to me. I'm learning.
Chapter 48, PK. Spring means kittens, and we are drowning in them. It's only April, and Rhonda says things will get worse before they get better. But that seems to be Rhonda's attitude toward everything, so I take it with a grain of salt. When Park comes in through the shelter's front door with a box full of mewling babies, I try to tell myself my heart jumped into my throat because I like kittens, and that's all. We agreed that we're just having fun for now, waiting out the last few months of high school with each other so that we don't have to be alone. Park got a decent baseball scholarship to a private school in Kentucky, and I'm headed to the Lutheran College, where preacher's kids get a deep discount. So there's already a countdown clock on my new relationship. But I've been telling myself that I'm okay with that. "Hey," he calls as soon as he sees me, raising the box in the air. "We've got it backward, babe. You're supposed to be the one delivering pussy." I swat at his arm, but not too hard.
"Where'd you find them?"
"Down by Lick Creek."
"You sure there's no mom?"
He shakes his head. "Nope. Whatever asshole dumped them found it in his heart to set out a bowl of milk for them as a going-away present. They..."
"Just crawled through it and got wet, yeah." I take his hand and pull him in the back, where we set up the kitten room. It's lined with heated beds and well-stocked with bottles and replacer formula. Alex is cross-legged on the ground, a tabby the size of her fist tucked in the crook of her arm while he takes his bottle.
"Someone else is in line for your love," I announce. "Also, I brought kittens," Park adds. "Hey, Alex."
She glances up.
"Hey, how many?"
"3,
he says, and Alex sets aside the tabby she's holding, who screams in protest when she tucks him in with his littermates. "One for each of us, then," Alex says, reaching into the box and handing me a kitten. Park takes a couple of steps back when she offers him a white one roughly the size of a mouse.
I don't..."
"They need to get warm," Alex says matter-of-factly, wrapping it in a heated towel and putting it into Park's hands. "Keep it close to your body." I sink to the floor with my kitten, and Park kind of slumps in defeat next to me, while Alex mixes fresh formula. I show Park how to hold the bottle at the right angle, and pretty soon all three of us are cupping kittens in our elbows, the only sound in the room their frantic suckling as they fill their empty bellies. I glance up at Park, and once again remind myself not to get in too deep. He's adorable with the bottle clenched in his huge hand, eyes locked onto the kitten. I kind of love his hands. They're huge and knuckly, so very male. I was worried that the first time he touched me I would freeze up, only able to think of vomiting in Alex's bathroom and the heavy smell of rubbing alcohol as I dumped a full bottle on my crotch. But it wasn't like that. Ray Parsons doesn't even exist when Park's hands are on me. But I don't think I'm in love. I don't think I was ever in love with Adam either. I just had him for so long that the idea of someone else getting him made me feel like I'd been robbed of something that belonged to me, but not something I couldn't live without. I knew I was really over him when Branley dumped Adam right before prom tickets went on sale, and I didn't think twice before accepting the one that Park bought me. And maybe I imagined it, but I think there might have been a little spark of panic in his eyes when he handed it to me, like our let's-have-fun arrangement might be off now that Adam was available again. The only reason Adam being free means anything to me is because Branley ditched him the second there was trouble between Alex and Jack, and now she's attached to Jack like a parasite. A really gorgeous parasite, true, but a life-sucker nonetheless. Jack can't get away from her. The day the guidance counselor announced his academic full ride to Hancock, Branley marched straight to the office and got her own application. I wasn't in love with Adam. I'm pretty sure I'm not in love with Park. Alex and Jack, they were in love.
I shift my kitten, and he lets out a pathetic little noise that breaks the silence. "He finished?" Alex asks. "I think so." I lift him up, his belly now round and full. "Time to pee," I tell him. Park says, glancing between me and Alex. "You have to make them go to the bathroom," Alex explains. "They won't do it on their own." Park's eyes get really big and I laugh at him. "You're excused," I say, taking his kitten from him and pulling a mama cat from the pile of stuffed animals in the corner. "Holy shit," Park says when he sees it, and I can't help but blush a little. Rhonda sewed a line of plastic nipples on the stuffed mama cats, explaining to us that kittens will suck for comfort even if they're not getting any food. And while it's certainly true that the orphans adore their new moms, it does make for some awkward moments in the human world. "It's a titty kitty," Park says, reaching for it, but I yank it away. "Time for you to go," I warn him and glance back at Alex. "You okay on your own for a minute?" "Yep," she says, eyes still locked on her bottle feeder. I walk Park out to the front, but he grabs my hand at the door.
"Is Alex okay?"
"Doing better," I tell him.
"Is she going to prom?"
"No. She doesn't have a date, and she said she doesn't want a third wheel us or Sarah."
"Like it would be hard for her to get one."
I choke back a laugh. "Yeah, you should go mention that to her. Just make sure there aren't any needles nearby."
"Tell her to go anyway," Park says. "What else has she got to do? Sit in a room full of stuffed animals with fake nipples?"
"Fair point," I say. "I'll see what I can do."
Chapter 49, Alex. In my mind, there is a scale. I do not know how many small lives add up to a big one, or if there is a formula to work it out. How many cats do I have to save? How many dogs? How many injured animals on the road do I have to drag to safety, their blood on my hands, their wild-smelling hair on my clothes? I think if there is a number, then it must be very large, and so I keep my eyes open as I drive, when I run, as I walk through the halls at school. I've scooted spiders out of the path of heavy feet, let a field mouse in through the front door in the middle of winter, swerved on ice to miss raccoons. Everything I can think of, anything I can do to make it better. I want to tell Jack that I'm doing these things, try to show him that if I don't have regret, exactly, then at least I have guilt. I put the words together, stitched them into sentences at night, hoping in the morning I will have the courage to spit them out like a string, the others flowing more easily after the first. But Branley is always with him, her normalcy so big and bright that I don't want to put myself next to her, my darkness in stark contrast. So I let it go. I feed the kittens, I listen to Park and Claire and their happiness, and I pick up the next orphan in the box. And the scale tips a tiny bit more.
Chapter 50, Jack. My free ride came in, a magic carpet in the shape of a piece of paper that people took pictures of me signing. Mom and Dad are smiling more, my future solidified by the swipe of a pen, though I know Mom's is bittersweet, and I can't even tell her I'll come home a lot, because I won't. Park is going to Kentucky, Branley is following me because her hooks don't extract easily, and the only other person I'd bother coming back for is Alex, who I can't think of without a wash of guilt and the taste of vomit in my throat. They made a big announcement at school because we haven't had anybody get a full ride since pocket change could pay tuition. They even had the marching band follow me around playing the fight song during one of the class changes. It was awkward and embarrassing and kind of awesome at the same time, and as I walked past the poster that has the senior countdown on it, I swear I choked up. Which doesn't make any sense, because all I've ever wanted to do is leave, and I've got a new fight song to learn anyway. Then I passed Park, and he pretended to punch me in the gut, and we wrestled each other down to the ground, and the band circled around us, still playing, because they didn't know what else to do. which was so goddamn funny. Park and I started laughing like idiots, and then PK called us both assholes, and Park grabbed her ankle and pulled her down with us. She held her instrument in the air as she fell and screamed, "Not my trumpet!" which was equally hilarious. It was a great fucking day, and I could pretend like there were tears in my eyes because I was laughing so hard. Nobody knew it was really because now that I get to leave, there's a part of me that's going to miss this place. And nobody knew that when I passed Alex, our eyes met, and I saw tears sitting in hers, too.
Chapter 51. PK. You do not just tell Alex Kraft she is going to prom. I'm pretty sure Alex has never done a single thing in her life that she didn't want to do. So finding a way to get her to prom is like casually suggesting to my dad that maybe he should consider Islam instead, just for variety. Sarah still needs a dress, so I told her we were taking Alex with us, hoping that somehow racks of dresses will have the same effect on her that depressed dogs in cages do. But Alex sits silently in the store, watching without comment as Sarah parades around in a bunch of dresses. Open torso, slit to the hip, cut to the breastbone, skirt so short you can see the curve of her ass. Finally, she puts on a deep purple one with an open back, and Alex speaks up. "That's the one," she says. They're the first words out of her mouth since she got in the car, so Sarah actually listens. I've been spouting out compliments and advice for the better part of an hour. My arms are weighed down with a magenta, maybe, and a flamingo pink, possibly. But it's Alex's solitary comment that gets Sarah's attention. "Why?" she asks, brow furrowed skeptically as she glances over her shoulder at Alex. "You've got great back muscles," Alex says. "I do, don't I?" Sarah agrees, checking herself out in the three-way mirror. "So what about you?" "What about me?" "Let's see those back muscles, girl." Alex actually laughs, but she waves Sarah off. "I'm not trying on dresses." "Why not?" "She claims she's not going to prom," I say. Sarah stops admiring herself and turns to glare at Alex. "Don't even tell me it's because of Jack effing Fisher." "Not entirely," Alex says. "I just don't want to go." Sarah crosses her arms, and I'm very glad I'm still half-hidden behind a pile of dresses in my arms. "Because of Jack effing Fisher." Listen. Sarah comes down the three steps from the elevated mirror to stand in front of Alex, skirts swishing as she walks. "Last year, when Alice told me I was just her experiment before she left for college, I wanted to crawl into a hole and die, like, totally and actually die. But did I do that?" Alex looks her up and down slowly. "Apparently not. I didn't want to go to school because she'd be there. I didn't want to go to practice because she'd be there. I didn't want to be a camp counselor because she'd be there too. So I had a choice. I could either not do anything for the rest of my life, or I could suck it up and act like it didn't bother me. And you know what? If you pretend long enough that it doesn't bother you, pretty soon it actually doesn't." "She's right," I say, craning my neck over the pile of silk and satin in my arms. "Remember how I was about Adam?" "Yeah," Sarah agrees, hands on her hips. "Pathetic." "Thanks a lot," I shoot back. Sarah reaches over blindly and pulls a dress out of my arms, the flamingo pink one with slashes in the torso. "So you're going to put on a dress, Alex Kraft, and on Monday you're going to buy a prom ticket." "I don't think that's my color," Alex says. "Then pick your own damn dress," Sarah says and punches her in the arm. Alex punches her back, and I bet anything they're both going to have bruises. But it doesn't matter because Alex is going through the racks, sliding hangers aside to give each dress a once-over before moving on. "Thanks," I say to Sarah. "For what?" I've been racking my brains trying to think of a way to talk her into going to prom. I never considered just yelling and punching her till she caved. "Well, if nothing else works, we'll just leave a trail of cheeseburgers up to the country club," Sarah says. "I heard that," Alex's voice soars out from the racks. Don't tell me it wouldn't work, Sarah calls back. Alex emerges with a few choices, and we rifle through them. Sarah sending her into the dressing room with firm instructions to make sure we see all of them. No cheating. I lean back in my chair while Sarah tells me about the girl she's bringing from Waterloo, and I'm not thinking about Adam or Park or anything. And it's really, really nice.
Chapter 52. Jack. Shit, shower, shave. This is how a guy gets ready for prom. Branley has been getting ready for 2 days. Yesterday was phase one, which involved a very long salon appointment that she informed me consisted mostly of waxing, and made a big deal out of telling me they had to order more wax ahead of time because she was very thorough. Today's phase two. Phase two is pedicure, manicure, hair, and makeup. She fills me in on the brand of makeup that, again, the salon had to order because the one place in town that will do facials doesn't carry the high-end stuff. And I couldn't give less of a fuck, but senior prom is going to be her crowning achievement, and there's a part I'm supposed to play. I know I'll end up in bed with her. Tonight I'm going to get drunk, probably be an asshole to a few people, and then I'm going to screw Branley because she wants me to. And if I'm being honest, the bottom half of me is into it, even if the top, where my brain and my heart are, knows that it's all wrong. And I shouldn't go to the lodge that a whole bunch of us went in on together for after prom. I shouldn't go because if I do, I'm the same Jack Fisher who started senior year, the guy who was led around by his dick and drank too much, the guy who hadn't ever been in love or had his heart broken, a guy who never knew Alex Kraft. But that guy was also happier in a lot of ways. He didn't know things that I know. I wiped the rest of the shaving cream off my chin, let Mom snap a couple of pictures of me in my tux, and then I head out the door. At Branley's house, there's a whole process involved. Her parents make me wait in the living room, and she actually comes down the stairs to me, like we're getting married or something. They video my reaction, and I don't have to fake it. She looks amazing. Stunning, absolutely gorgeous. I tell her that, and I mean it, and she actually blushes a little. I can see it under all the makeup, and it makes me want to tell her to wash her face, put on a pair of jeans, and we'll go up to the lodge early, wade in the stream like we used to when we were kids. But her mom is pinning a boutonniere on me, tinted to perfectly match Branley's dress, seafoam green. I know this because I've been informed many, many times. And if I said, let's drop the shit and just be ourselves, there'd be hundreds of dollars thrown away. So I put on my fake smile, and her parents take about 1,000 pictures and tell us what a beautiful couple we make. And I bite down on my lip because I don't know if we are a couple or ever have been. Branley laughs and smiles, rests her head on my shoulder, leaving behind a flesh-colored smudge of makeup on my jacket that I really hope will come off because I can't afford to pay any kind of cleaning fee. Then we're in the car, and I'm trying to drive, but Branley keeps putting her hand on my leg, her head on my arm, touching me so much that it's distracting more than erotic, and all I can think about is that this is what college will be like. She'll follow me around, and her hands will be on me all the time, feeling, touching, kneading, and I'll give her whatever she wants, because I always have, and that'll just make it worse. My grades will slip, and I'll lose my scholarship, and have to drop out, and Branley will follow me home, and fuck, I probably will end up marrying her, and we'll have kids, and they'll go up to the church to make out with the kids of the people we're going to see at prom tonight. Stop touching me, I say. My voice so hollow, she actually listens. I glance over, and I can tell she's hurt, but I can't let it bother me. Not after the thoughts that just chased through my brain. An endless loop that I can't stop picturing. Prom is a sea of colors, all of them vying for attention, much like the girls wearing them. Red, green, blue, a few brave souls in yellow, a couple of colors I'm pretty sure don't even have names, and definitely don't occur in nature. What I see the most of, though, is flesh, everywhere. Technically, prom is supposed to follow dress code, but the teachers know that if they toss some kid who spent hundreds of bucks on a prom dress, they'll have to deal with a pissed-off parent, whether it shows her areoli or not. So there's legs and tits everywhere, quite a few midriffs, shiny white teeth flashing out from behind lips coated with gloss, shining unnaturally beneath the lights. I brought a flask, and I've been helping myself a little more than is probably smart, but I don't know how else.